Today, we are going to be talking to George Takei, an actor best known for his role as Lieutenant Sulu on the original Star Trek, as well as a longtime human rights activist and spokesperson. He's the co-author right now of the just-released and on the New York Times bestseller list graphic memoir, They Called Us Enemy. He's also got a series that he'll be talking about a little bit later coming out on AMC, a 10-part series about more or less the same subject. He's got 2.9 million followers on Twitter and I think like 10 million followers on Facebook. So basically at the age of 82, he has more going on than he had when he was 28. that's a good place to be. So first of all, thank you so much for doing this.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
And we're not going to be talking about Star Trek today, although I would be remiss if I didn't say that in 1966, I was in seventh grade. So I mean, you still appear in my dreams from time to time. I was such a perfect target audience for Star Trek.
Well, I was your dream boy.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but maybe, who knows. So what we are going to be talking about is They Called Us Enemy. This is a graphic memoir. It is about a very upsetting time in your life and a very upsetting time, a very bad time in the history of America. I'm going to let you start out the story. The story begins with you as a child, I believe a child of five, being awakened under frightening circumstances. Tell us what was happening.
Yes, I had just turned 5 years old on April 20th, 1942, and it was a few weeks after that birthday that my parents got me up very early one morning, together with my brother, a year younger, he was four, and our baby sister, who was an infant. And they dressed us hurriedly, and my brother and I were told to wait in the living room while our parents did some last-minute packing in the bedroom. And so my brother and I were just standing by the front window, gazing out, and suddenly we saw two soldiers marching up our driveway. They carried rifles with shiny bayonets on them. They stomped up the porch and with their fist began pounding on the front door. It was a terrifying sound. The whole house seemed to tremble with that pounding. My father came out of the bedroom and answered the door, and literally at gunpoint, we were ordered out of our home. My father gave my brother and me small packages to carry. He hefted two heavy suitcases, and we followed him out onto the driveway, and we stood there waiting for our mother to come out. And when she finally came out, she had our baby sister in one arm and a huge duffel bag in the other, and tears were streaming down her cheeks. It was a terrifying morning that I can never forget.
And this is all having to do with so-called Executive Order 9066. This Roosevelt's executive order that gave the military broad powers to ban any citizen from a 50 to 60 mile wide coastal area stretching from Washington State to California and extending inland into southern Arizona. This you're experiencing the beginning of the internment of Japanese Americans at this moment, right?
That's correct.
So, you know, it might be worthwhile to just dial back a little bit and set the scene a little bit more and talk about who your family was. Your mom was a U.S. citizen. Your dad wasn't, but he was an Anglophile. You were named after King George VI, is that correct?
That's right. I was born in 1937, the year that King George VI was crowned. My father was born in Japan, a province called Yamanashi at the foot of Mount Fuji. But he lost his mother, my grandmother, paternal grandmother, when he was very young. And my widower grandfather, decided he's going to seek new opportunities in the U.S. And so he came to San Francisco with his two boys. My father was the younger of the two boys. And so my father grew up in San Francisco. He was reared there, educated there, and he always considered himself a San Franciscan. And he was very Americanized. He spoke English fluently, Japanese fluently. And so we were Americans. But when Pearl Harbor was bombed, hysteria, fear of another bombing on the West Coast would hit. And that fear, that hysteria, swept all across this country. And we happened to look different from the rest of America. We happened to look just like the people that bombed Pearl Harbor. And so that hysteria, together with racism, combined to stampede even the President of the United States. And he signed, as you said, the executive order numbered 9066, which ordered all of us to be imprisoned with no charges. Mm-hmm. There were no charges. Therefore, no trial. Due process, the central pillar of our justice system, simply disappeared. And the soldiers came to our home and rounded us up together with 120,000 other Japanese Americans from the West Coast and imprisoned us in 10 barbed wire prison camps in some of the most hellish places, most isolated places in the United States. We were, on February 19th, President Roosevelt signed the executive order, and the construction of the barbed wire prison camps began. But when we were rounded up, the construction wasn't finished yet. So we were taken to Santa Anita Racetrack, mm-hmm. a glamorous racetrack where movie stars used to go and bet on horses. But that became a assembly center was the term that they used. There was a chain link fence around this once glamorous racetrack with concertina wires around at the top, and armed U.S. military men were guarding over us. It became a temporary internment camp where we were housed in horse stalls. Mm. We were herded over to the stable area, and each family of comparable size to ours, we were three children and two parents, five of us, and we were assigned a horse stall, still pungent with the stink of horse manure. Mm. But to five-year-old me, I thought it was fun to sleep where the horsies sleep.
Right.
And we showered where the horses were washed outdoors. Men went first, and we went with our father and my mother with the women's group later on. We were treated like animals.
You know, I want to back up and just let people hear the beginnings of how that fear sounded. So you're going to hear actually the voice of Eleanor Roosevelt speaking to the nation in 1941.
I'm speaking to you tonight at a very serious moment in our history. The Cabinet is convening and the leaders in Congress are meeting with the President. The State Department and Army and Navy officials have been with the President all afternoon. In fact, the Japanese ambassador was talking to the President at the very time that Japan's airships were bombing our citizens in Hawaii and the Philippines. By tomorrow morning, the members of Congress will have a full report and be ready for action. In the meantime, we, the people, are already prepared for action.
So the first thing that happened that day, the same day that she's speaking, President Roosevelt signed a declaration that every adult Japanese citizen was considered an alien enemy who must abide by strict regulations, 8 p.m. curfew, couldn't travel more than 5 miles from home or work, couldn't get on an airplane of any kind, and assets, homes, farms, crops, farm equipment were eventually all seized by the government. In a kind of George Orwell style, George Takei, there was a bizarre argument that was made by a man who's actually gone down in history as kind of a champion of human rights, kind of a champion of the underdog, and that's Earl Warren, who eventually became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. At the time, he's California's Attorney General, and he makes this remarkable claim that the reason to suspect Japanese citizens is because there was no reason Japanese American citizens was because there was no reason to suspect them. That was the reason to suspect them.
Yes, he made the statement, we have no reports of sabotage or spying or fifth column activities by Japanese Americans, and that is ominous because we Japanese Americans are inscrutable, that stereotyping word. And so there, it would be prudent to lock us up before we do anything. So the absence of evidence for this attorney general, the top attorney in the state of California, was the evidence. The absence of evidence was the evidence. And that justified locking us up.
And even before the locking up, when you start to talk about people that way, when you start to talk about a certain group of American citizens that way, or any group of people who might be on American soil that way, you begin to open them up. You turn them into targets for harassment. I'm assuming that is something that happened to Japanese American citizens after they were classified as alien enemies.
That's right. I mean, all the here at the Japanese American National Museum in Los Angeles, we have all these photographs of ugly graffiti painted on walls. Japs keep on moving. Japs, you don't belong here. Japs go home. And that's kind of an echo that we hear today of go home or lock her up. Mm-hmm. The slogan was, lock up the Japs. So we keep repeating history. And I wrote my autobiography in 1994 with this chapter of American history as the beginning of my autobiography. But still, to this day, I'm confronted by people that I consider well-read, well-informed people. When I tell them about my childhood imprisonment, they're shocked. Mm-hmm. And I'm shocked that they're shocked because I've been lecturing at universities all across the country. We've put on a musical on Broadway about the imprisonment of Japanese Americans.
Allegiance.
And the tragedy of that story. And I thought, the best way, perhaps, to reach or hope for the future of America is to make it a comic strip. Mm-hmm. I read comic books, and I still remember some of the stories that I read. And I thought, if we reach the young reader, the teenagers and the young American readers, and they, you know, that's at that age when you're absorbing in information and you keep it for the rest of your lives, then we will have another generation of Americans, but this time informed on the dark chapters of American history. And if we have enough Americans in the future that know this history, hopefully it won't repeat itself. But alas, we are repeating
now. Right. And I want to play a clip here that'll sort of give you a sense of what George Takei is saying about how some of the rhetoric of 1941 sounded an awful lot like things that we hear today. This is from news footage recorded 3 months before the opening of the American internment camps for Japanese American citizens.
Frankly, my view is, and I include the German so-called, in what I have to say about the Japanese, we ought to exterminate both of them. There's no place for either of those races in the world today.
What do you think of the Japs, the Japanese people?
Well, I...
You hate them.
No, I don't hate them.
There must be a good many people in Japan who don't believe and don't support this war. Do you think they are racially treacherous?
Pin up all the Japanese in this country so they can't do us any dirt. Not just through the duration of the war, but all of them we just pin them up and keep them. Keep them, never give anybody else any trouble.
So George Takei, echoes of today in some of those comments in the way that people were depicted. You know, I want to hone in on something you said. You talk about how surprised you are when you find out that Americans just don't know this, don't know that you were at the age of five imprisoned along with so many other Japanese Americans. You know, the thing that I've been finding lately, and I don't know if you've run into this or not, but as the conversation has heated up about the facilities along the border where families are being separated, families are being held in squalid conditions, you know, when I bring up the American internment of Japanese Americans, I bring it up the way I assumed 100% of Americans did, as an incredible article of shame. But I've actually run into people on social media and elsewhere who instead cited as kind of a benign precedent, saying, oh yeah, we can do this. We did it in 1941 with the Japanese Americans, as if that made it okay that it had been done before. Have you run into that particular twist on history?
Well, social media has become rampant with trolls who are totally mindless, and I think there seems to be a streak of evil in them. I can't believe intelligent people could say and do the kind of things that they say on social media. I've come across all of that still today. They say, you know, well, my father fought in the Pacific Theater, and the Japs did this and that. Well, we were Americans. I mean, they just can't draw that distinction. I mean, there are people, you know, America, the United States is a diverse country with people that have come from all over the world. All of us are descendants of immigrants at one point or another. My grandparents were the ones that came to the United States. And whether they came from Italy or Norway or Latin America, we're all from from somewhere else in the world. And that's our strength as Americans, our diversity coming together. And if we can work together as a people, united as a team, and taking advantage of our diversity, then we can be the ideal of what our founding fathers imagined. But we are fallible human beings.
I want to tell people a little bit more about how these camps were depicted to Americans, and then have George Takei talk a little bit about what the reality of those camps are. So take a quick break and a deep breath. We're going to come back with George Takei to talk a little bit more about some of the stories contained in his newly released graphic memoir, They Called Us In.
He said the U.S. is looking for spies, so we have to live in a place called Mandanar, where a lot of Japanese people are. Stop it, don't look at the gunmen. You don't want to get the soldiers wondering if you're gonna run or not, cause if you run then you might get shot. Other than that, try not to think about it, try not to worry about it being so crowded. But someday we'll get out, someday, someday.
As soon as war broke out, so the FBI came and they just come to the house and you have to.
We're back. We're talking to George Takei. You probably know him for his role as Lieutenant Sulu on the original Star Trek, as well as being a longtime human rights activist and spokesperson. He's got a new book out now. It's a graphic memoir of his childhood. It's called They Called Us Enemy. In a little while, too, he'll tell us about a new series coming on AMC that also talks about the American internment of Japanese Americans. Before we come back with George Takei, I want to play a clip from a 1942 Office of War Information Motion Picture Bureau propaganda film designed to alleviate concerns some Americans were having about how the Japanese Americans were being relocated. So in this film, you see, in this clip, you would see buses full of smiling Japanese families being driven to their happy new homes in these various camps. You see children playing, classes are being taught, men are working, everything is just wonderful. Here's what that sounded like.
Now they were taken to racetracks and fairgrounds where the Army almost overnight had built assembly centers. Santa Anita Racetrack, for example, suddenly became a community of about 17,000 persons. Here they would build schools, educate their children, held church services, issued their own newspaper, organized nursery schools, and some made camouflage nets for the United States Army. At weekly community meetings, citations were given to the block leaders who had worked most diligently. Now, this brief picture is actually the prologue to a story that is yet to be told. The full story will begin to unfold when circumstances permit the loyal American citizens once again to enjoy the freedom we in this country cherish, and when the disloyal have left this country for good. In the meantime, we are setting a standard for the rest of the world in the treatment of people who may have loyalties to an enemy nation. We are protecting ourselves without violating the principles of Christian decency.
So, George Takei, you already talked about Santa Anita, which is mentioned in that clip, that you were basically living in horse stalls and taking showers in the horse paddock. But much like what we're hearing along the border these days, this is not a sanitary way for people to be living. It's much easier for sickness to spread in an environment like that. So what happened to your family? Did you guys get sick?
As a matter of fact, I do remember getting sick, but we were in horse stalls, and my parents had to go for some meeting or whatever, and so they had our neighbor lady in the next stall. All she had to do was peer over the partition, and she would say, "Georgie, are you all right?" And I would say, "I'm fine, thank you." And she would sit down on her cot and do whatever she was doing. It was, and my baby sister got sick too. And I remember, I was well by then, the medicine was dispensed from a little kind of a ticket box in the middle of the stable area. And since my father was someplace else, my mother would take my brother and me and my sick baby sister to that ticket office and get the medicine for her. So, yes, illness was rampant at Santa Anita.
Now, Santa Anita was intended to be temporary. Your next stop was in Arkansas. And as I understand it, all of you were tagged like cattle with these little pieces of paper to keep track of who you were and then loaded onto trains. And maybe you can pick up the story there about your travel from Santa Anita to this new camp in Arkansas.
That's correct. We were tagged. We had to wear the tag all the time, and we were put on trains with armed guards, sentries at both ends of each car, as if we were criminals. They treated us like animals, or on the train like criminals. And occasionally, you know, they'd be a boring job for them. So, you know, they had to maintain that parade rest position, but they would occasionally move and thump their rifle on the floor, and we got used to it. And my father told us that we were going on a long vacation, and so I thought everybody went on vacation to a place called Arkansas with armed escorts. But whenever we reached a town on the way, then the shade had to be drawn. We were not to be seen. But I remember, you know, I was a curious kid, and I was right by the window. And so when my mother wasn't looking, I shoved the shade up a little bit and to look outside, because I heard wonderful sounds of trolleys being rolled across or people talking and laughing. But whenever we got caught, my mother would slam the shade down so that the guards wouldn't catch us. But I thought this was normal. I thought this was the way people went on vacations. And it was, what did my mother always chant? 4 days and three nights. 4 days and three nights to get to the camp. And when we arrived at the camp, the train tracks ran right alongside the barbed wire fence. And there were already people there, and my mother recognized a few people, and she waved at them. And the guards were shouting out the name of the camp, which was Roher, R-O-H-W-E-R. But to me, it sounded like roar, roar. I thought they were pretending to be lions, and I thought, isn't that silly, these guards roaring like lions? So it was a parallel experience that I had, totally different from that of my parents. Same experience, but parallel experiences. And may I read one part which captures that difference? My bright, sharp memories are of joyful times of games, play, and discoveries. Memory is a wily keeper of the past, usually dependable, but at times deceptive. Childhood memories are especially slippery, sweet, and so full of joy, they can often be a misrendering of the truth. For a child, that sweetness, out of context and intensely subjective, remains forever real. I know that I will always be haunted by the larger, vaguely remembered reality of the circumstances surrounding my childhood. This was written originally for my autobiography, which was published in 1994, but I share it again in this graphic memoir where we tell the story of my childhood internment, imprisonment, from the eyes of an absolutely irresistibly adorable five-year-old me. And that's thanks to Harmony Becker, a very gifted manga artist. She captures emotions on a face with a dot and the swoop of a line or a squiggle here. It's absolutely magical what she is able to do with her drawing.
Well, in the interest of time, I'm going to leap over a lot of Camp Roher, and I'm going to take us to 1943, when President Roosevelt begins allowing some Japanese American citizens to enlist in the Army. But a very fateful questionnaire was issued to all the interned Japanese American citizens, asking in particular two questions that would very much affect their destinies. The questions are often, in retrospect, regarded as somewhat confusing, ambiguous, difficult to answer one way or another, but they were yes and no questions. Question 27 asked if Japanese American men were willing to serve on combat duty wherever.
No, everyone, not just men. Everyone over the age of 17, man or woman, 17 or 87.
If they would be willing to serve in other ways, such as serving in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, all that kind of stuff. And I'll have you summarize what question 28 said, George Takei.
Question 28 was one sentence with two opposite ideas. I'm going to paraphrase, but this is the essence of the two ideas in one sentence. It asked, will you swear your loyalty to the United States of America and forswear your loyalty to the Emperor of Japan? The Emperor of Japan. We're Americans. My mother was born in Sacramento, California. My father was born in Japan, but he was brought to San Francisco as a child, and he's always considered himself a San Franciscan. And we never had a loyalty to the Emperor. But The government presumed that we had an inborn racial loyalty to the emperor, which was insulting. So if you answered no, meaning I don't have a loyalty to the emperor to forswear, that no applied to the first part of the very same sentence. Will you swear your loyalty to the United States? If you answered yes, meaning I do swear my loyalty to the United States, then that yes applied to the second part of that sentence meant that you were confessing that you had been loyal to the emperor and now were prepared to forswear that loyalty and repledge your loyalty to the emperor of Japan. This was an ignorant question that the Japanese American took as deeply offensive. Insulting.
So your parents answered no because of that.
And, it was preposterous.
And the consequences were huge. They were reclassified as disloyals. Your family was transferred to a much more militarized camp in California, a notorious place called the Tule Lake Relocation Center. You know, we've avoided, because it's so controversial, the term concentration camp in this conversation so far, but it's not much of a stretch to call Tule Lake a concentration camp. This was a highly militarized facility where you were truly treated as enemies at this point.
Let me define the word concentration camp according to the dictionary. It's the concentrated imprisonment of people that have in common a heritage or race or culture or faith for political purposes. That's the definition of a concentration camp. And so all 10 of the prison camps that we were imprisoned in were concentration camps. People conflate that with the Jewish Holocaust in Europe. That is a whole different kind of camp. They were concentrated not for political purposes, but the intent was a systematic program of a campaign of annihilation of a people. They were death camps. They were extermination camps. Concentration camp becomes almost a euphemism when used in the context of the Holocaust. We Japanese Americans were imprisoned in concentration camps. But to really underscore the militarized nature of Tule Lake, the segregation camp for disloyals, it had 3 layers of barbed wire fences and a half a dozen tanks patrolling the perimeter to intimidate people who were goaded into outrage by, you know, the series of outrages. And the loyalty questionnaire coming a year into imprisonment was really beyond rationality, because right after Pearl Harbor, young Japanese Americans, like almost all young Americans, rushed to their recruitment centers to volunteer to serve in the U.S. military. This was answered with a denial. They were denied military service and categorized as enemy aliens, and then imprisoned. Imprisoned for a year until the government realized that there's a wartime manpower shortage. And here were all these young people that they could have had, but had been classified as enemy aliens. How to justify drafting people out of a barbed wire prison camp? Their solution was this ill put together loyalty questionnaire. And there were thousands of young people who were so determined to prove their loyalty that they bit the bullet, swallowed that ugly taste, and answered the questions as they thought the government wanted them to. And they answered with yeses to those 2 offensive questions. And they went to fight in the military. They were put into a segregated all-Japanese-American unit and sent to the battlefields of Europe. And there, They were literally used like cannon fodder, but they fought with incredible courage and, indeed, heroism, and they sustained the highest combat casualty rate of any unit of its comparable size. When the war ended, they came back to the United States as the single most decorated unit of the entire war, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the segregated all-Japanese-American unit. And they were welcomed back on the White House lawn by President Harry Truman, who said to them, "You fought not only the enemy, but prejudice, and you won." But when the loyalty questionnaire came down, there were also another kind of heroes. They were the young men who said, "I am an American, and I will fight for my country, but I will fight as an American. If I can report to my hometown draft board with my family back home, I would be like any American. I would have something to fight for. I will fight as an American, but I will not go as an internee, leaving my family in imprisonment, to put on the same uniform as that of the guards imprisoning my family. I will fight as an American." Now, I think these people were courageous people to take on the might of the entire United States, but they were also principled people and very American young men. And for that position that they stood on, they were tried for draft evasion, found guilty, and transferred to Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary, where they fought on a different battlefield behind those tall penitentiary concrete walls. But they stood strong and proud as Americans against all the guff that they had to put up with and the assaults on them in the Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. So there are these two stories, equally heroic. One, fighting for this country on those battlefields and sacrificing so much, and the other, fighting behind federal penitentiary walls for the very principle of what America must stand for. So this is a story of the Japanese-American heroism, one behind penitentiary walls and other on European battlefields.
We're talking right now to George Takei. He has a new graphic novel-style memoir out about his childhood in an American internment camp for Japanese Americans. You know him, of course, from Star Trek. He'll be back after this. Today's show was essentially a special project entirely put on the air by producer Josh Nalea. The part of Bill Curry was played by William Shatner. We think we know what tomorrow's show is. I'm going to be honest with you, okay? I'm taping this, I don't know, it's like a week back in time. This is a quantum experience I'm having right now. So I think I know what tomorrow's show is. I'm not 100% sure. I wouldn't want to lie to you. So let's just get back to our interview with George Takei. Once again, George Takei, you knew him, you loved him as Sulu on Star Trek. He's a lot more than that. He's become an internet activist. And right now he has a memoir out in graphic novel form about his childhood, which was spent in American internment camps for Japanese Americans during World War II. Let's get back to that conversation.
You, George Takei, and your family spent 2 years at Tula Lake, which was notorious for, yes, all that barbed wire, but also really pretty squalid living conditions, inadequate medical care, bad food. This is not a place to be And eventually the Supreme Court forced the closure of these camps. And maybe you can just say, what was your family's mindset, your parents' mindset? Your parents who had been patriotic citizens of the United States, they had a successful dry cleaning business when this all started. As you say, your mother born here, your father comes here at an early age. His family are Anglophiles enough to name him after King George VI. How did that spirit survive this kind of maltreatment for so many years?
It was a series of outrages by the United States government. At the Tule Lake camp, young men who had initially volunteered to fight for this country had by this time now become radicalized, and their attitude was, all right, you're going to consider us the enemy and treat us this way and demand that kind of loyalty questionnaire? We will, and they had answered no, no to that. They said, we're going to show you what kind of enemy you have to put up with. We will become the enemy that you imagine us to be. And they became very physically activist. They jogged around the block with the headband wrapped around their head with the Japanese military flag, the rising sun with the rays on it, and they used the Japanese cadence instead of up, two, three, four. They would go, washoi, washoi, washoi. And I remember waking up at Tule Lake in the morning to that cadence. And then, of course, the jeeps would come roaring in to break it up, and they were scattered into the barracks. And so it was a very intense, militarized environment, both on the part of the guards as well as the internees. And Congress became very frustrated with that. And so they said, all right, if you're going to be so Japanese, then we're going to give you the right to renounce your citizenship. They were all, you know, American-born. And so they passed the bill that's called the Denaturalization Bill, which permitted American citizens to renounce their citizenship during wartime in a barbed wire prison camp, and particularly a prison camp with three layers of barbed wire fences and intimidating tanks patrolling the perimeter. That in itself is an outrageously un-American act. And so these radicals acted on it, and they renounced their citizenship. But that was only a few, and Congress wanted more people to renounce. And so to really intimidate the people imprisoned at Tule Lake, they announced that in 1944, when the war was still raging, they're going to close down Tule Lake. They're going to let out all of the internees. There were rednecks taking pot shots at white people driving in to visit us in the internment camps. What's going to happen when we, you know, the irony of the barbed wire fence was, yes, that confined us, but it also protected us from the radicals outside. And when the government threatened to let us out, no barbed wire fence, and we were going to be open to any kind of hate out there. It was terrifying. And the radicals then campaigned to say, if we get enough people to renounce their citizenship, then we can force the government to keep Tule Lake operating. Mm. And out of fear and in an effort to protect the family, my mother did that incredible thing of renouncing her American citizenship and helped keep Tule Lake up and protecting us. But then when the war ended, that renunciation came back to bite us like with a vengeance.
Mm.
My mother's name was on the list of a ship sailing for Japan to deport the renunciants. My mother was born in Sacramento, California. If they were going to deport her, that's the place that they should have sent her to. But she was going to send her, and we were going to go with her. I mean, we're going to be a family. We were going to be sent to a war-torn, devastated country. The people there are scrambling in the ruins to find food or clothing. We were going to be sent there. I don't know what I would have turned out to be. I would have been definitely a different person if we were on that ship.
You know, before we run out of time, there's just, well, first of all, I want to make sure we mention George Takei, this 10-episode dramatization that's coming out on AMC. Tell us what it's called again.
It's called The Terror Infamy.
The Terror
Infamy, taken from the word that he used to characterize Japan's bombing of Pearl Harbor. But infamy, in this case, is 4 years of infamy that President Roosevelt inflicted on us.
You know, and I want to just ask you one last question about sort of who you did become. As you said, had all that happened, you would have become a different person. You've become obviously passionately political. You're still passionately political on a daily basis. But I also just want to mention that, okay, 1966, I'm this dopey seventh grader watching Star Trek. You're probably the first Japanese person of Japanese ancestry that I see on TV who's not in a war movie. I mean, you know, in terms of representation of Japanese people, Japanese American people, you know, I don't think there was much other than as former enemies. And suddenly here we are confronted with this idealistic utopian vision of the future where kind of a multiracial, multinational, multiplanetary group would work together for betterment. You must be somewhat proud of the fact that in a way, you know, you stood in for a lot of people who had never been so positively represented.
I am proud of that, very proud of that, and I'm grateful to Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, who put together that vision of his, infinite diversity in infinite combinations, and to envision our human future as one where our diversity working together is our strength. The diversity is the strength, and our working together in unison is our power. And so I'm very grateful to Gene Roddenberry for have cast me in that role.
So we've been talking to George Takei, the graphic memoir, which is already leaping up the bestseller list of the New York Times. The graphic memoir is called They Called Us Enemy. It has been an honor and a privilege to talk to you, sir. And if you'll just grant me this one wish, Mr. Sulu, set a course for the next break.
Aye, aye, sir. Warp 3.
Thank
and
you
may
so much.
You live long and prosper.
thank you so much, George Takei.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So it turns out that the break comes at the end of the show. It's a break with our show. But we've had a great time with George Takei. Thanks very much to Josh Nalea, the producer who set this whole thing up. And one of my childhood dreams has been fulfilled. How many days can you say that? Come back tomorrow for whatever it is we're doing.
It's I am not a criminal. It's real. And I 10710. Pack your things, we leave tomorrow. Sip. a criminal. But this wire fence is real.